Well, thank you for that, David. And welcome, everyone, to our study of the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. And I just want to pause for one moment to express my appreciation to David for all the work he's put in to making this opportunity for us to meet together available. Your efforts are not unnoticed, David, and thank you. My name is Doug Thompson, in case anyone didn't know, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. I want to start today's program by asking everyone to take a moment to remember why we have come together to share in the study of the words which Jesus dictated to Helen and Bill. Jesus said, "Wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there also shall I be." And I not only believe he said that, I believe he is here with us. We are gathered in his name. We began this original dictation series in February, and most of the 36 hours of reading and commentary since that time have been recorded and are available as streaming audio on my website. And I'm supposed to say that every week, and I almost never remember to do it, so I'm remembering this time. And there's the URL for the archive. For those on the radio, I'm going to read you the URL in about 5 minutes. And for those who are here for the first time, and I see a few names I'm not familiar with, and who knows who's on the radio, I'm going to provide a bit of a background on what we're doing here, and those who are already familiar with this part can take a 5 minute break here. As most of you know, the Course exists in a number of versions as a result of extensive editing and abridgment over the years. While anyone looking at the earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that some parts certainly needed some editing, some of that editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally somewhat clearer. In fact, some of the most important teachings in the early part of the Course simply vanished along the way. We don't know exactly how that happened. So one reason for studying this material is that it gives us a clearer picture, not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Bill, what he actually meant. Some of us have found this clarity of understanding to be useful. The earliest written record of A Course in Miracles is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes, and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. I'm frequently asked about other versions of the Course which are also advertised or labeled as in some ways original. There are actually 6 different versions of the text of the Course of which I'm aware, and 5 for which I've been able to obtain copies. From the longest to the shortest, they vary in length by some 50,000 words. Most of these have been published, and in most cases, the publisher claims each is in some way original. This inevitably generates confusion. So what we're working with here today is original in the sense of being what was originally written down by Helen before the editing process began. What I've been doing for the past few months is going through the notes and identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext manuscript, and combining these two earliest and most original versions in order to obtain everything that was written down. The resulting document is therefore not any one of the 5 known historical scribal versions, but rather a combination of these two earliest ones. It includes essentially all of the original dictation for which we have any documentary evidence. Now, some of this material does have some rough spots. Some segments were written down only in point form, and some sentences were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need editing in places. The notes also include some material specifically labeled as a private point and not part of the Course. It also includes some diary entries from Helen herself, which are clearly not part of the Course, but having been made at the same time that the dictation was being received and reflecting on her responses to it, they give us essentially some added depth about the process that she was experiencing as she was receiving this material. And in that sense, they can be useful. There's also conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen at the time. And again, while not part of the course proper, these outtakes, if you will, provide some insight into Helen's experience and often involve additional explanations of miracle principles, along with practical examples from Helen's own life to illustrate those principles. And as such, they can expand and clarify our understanding of the course proper, as well as the scribing experience, which resulted in what we know of today as A Course in Miracles. So what we're doing today will be a reading, some commentary, and discussion of this material. Last week we got as far as T2B 60, and actually we got to 62, but we're going to go back and start at 60 because that's really the beginning of the section. Now the first eight chapters of this combined original dictation are available on the net at this URL, which I'm going to post. And you can load that up and follow along with us. For those on the radio who might not be able to see, who can't see that, and who might want to follow along, if you go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74, you will get a message, you will get a screen, in the top left corner of which you can click on the original dictation, chapters 1 to 8, and you'll get that same document. And also, on that same screen, in that same corner, you'll see the archive link, which will take you to the list of previous sessions in this thread and a few other interesting things that I have on there in audio format, which are available as streaming audio, or you can download an MP3 file. Now, the basic format we're using is reading and commentary plus discussion. There tends to be a lot more commentary and discussion than reading sometimes. And while I'd encourage everyone to raise your hand if you have something to share, I'd also appreciate it if you try to keep your comments focused to the topic at hand and try to keep it under 3 minutes unless something truly exceptional arises, which sometimes happens. Deborah will be keeping an eye on the hands on the board, and she's like the moderator here. When she acknowledges your hand and drops the mic, then you can take the mic. Towards the end of the 2 hours, I'll be asking for questions again and attempt to make a summary of some of the key points we've covered in this session. And at this point, I'm going to ask Deborah to take the mic and do her introduction. Here you go, Deb.
Hey, can I be heard? Do you hear my voice? Yep, thank you. Thanks, Doug. So it'll be very brief. It's just a hi, everybody. Very good to see yous. And I was looking forward to Sunday, although actually this morning I was planning my day and I thought I'd go up and visit my dad, who's a three-hour drive up, a three-hour drive back. And then I suddenly remembered, oh my God, I can't. It's the sessions on today. So mostly I remember it, and I really look forward to it. So, Jesus, help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today, if you will tell me what to do. Only that I will to do. And Lord, heal me. And amen. And with that, if there's no questions about anything or comments to start with, then I'm going to commence with reading at T2B60, and I'll post the link again, which also has the starting place on it. Is my volume fine? Because it has been in the past where it hasn't been really wonderful, but nobody has said anything. It's fine. Thanks, Carmen. Okay. Here I go. Here's my marker. Or my guide, my postcard with oh man, I forget who, Hahnemann, of course. Defense, disruptions, and disorientation at T2B60. You know that when defenses are disrupted, there is a period of real disorientation accompanied by fear, guilt, and usually vacillations between anxiety and depression. Doug, you have your hand up, so I'm going to pass it over to you. I can start this paragraph again.
Okay. I stuck my hand up early to make sure you'd see it when you got to the end. However, I just wanted to remind people that who are looking at the file on the net, that the green sidebar on the left, if you click on defense disruption, just above T2C, sort of at the beginning, towards the beginning of chapter 2, you'll go straight to that paragraph. Otherwise, whenever you hear a paragraph reference, it's going to be something like T2B60. That means text, chapter 2, section B, paragraph 60. And the fields are all separated by spaces, so if you type control F, T space, 2 space, B space, 60, your browser will take you to the beginning of that paragraph directly. And the interpretation, the disorientation being discussed here, those who've been with us before will remember that there was a lot of talk about uprooting and disequilibrium and channelizing new learning and overcoming old learning going on in chapter 1. And this is referring back to that discussion. And what Jesus has been doing is talking about various ego defenses and how they block our ability to, essentially, how they serve as blocks to the awareness of love's presence. And that they need to be reinterpreted, but the reinterpretation of defenses by the Holy Spirit can be experienced as the disruption of defenses, which leads to vertigo, disorientation, a feeling of being uprooted, disequilibrium, fear, guilt, anxiety, depression. And he's basically telling Helen and Bill and the rest of us that as we proceed with the course, this is going to happen. Every time an ego defense, every time a block to the awareness of love's presence is removed or is reinterpreted, there's going to be some discomfort associated with it. And don't be worried about that kind of discomfort, because he says essentially it's inevitable. This process is different, and then he goes on here to say, only in that defenses are not being disrupted but reinterpreted, even though it may be experienced as the same thing. Okay, so this would take us to T2B61. Deborah, here you go.
And with that, I just want to add that there's been times when I have experienced that out of the blue, and also, I mean, while reading actually A Course in Miracles, and Teddy, who's here, can attest of one that we mutually went through at a certain time. And I think it also worked with Lee as well, who was in the background, kind of, which is pretty fascinating. But it's happened with me during very simple therapeutic processes of changing my mind on something, and it can be so incredibly powerful where this disorientation, not knowing anything around me anymore, and headaches and dizziness, nauseousness, all kinds of bodily symptoms can come forth as well. So it's pretty fascinating. I'm sure a lot of you has experienced these symptoms, these experiences. So I'll go on with T2B61. In the reinterpretation of defenses, they are not disrupted, but they're used for attack is lost. Since this means they can be used only one way, they become much stronger and much more dependable. They no longer oppose the atonement, but greatly facilitate it. The atonement can only be accepted within you. Doug.
Okay, I just want to remind people that the atonement has been defined for us as undoing. And the undoing has been detailed in terms of undoing ego defenses that are blocks to the awareness of love's presence. And as the defenses are undone and reinterpreted, they become the atonement. They become themselves engines of undoing, and much stronger because they can no longer be used for attack. But this undoing and atonement cannot be imposed or forced on anyone. It can only be accepted as a choice of will by free will. The atonement can only be accepted within you. And that's what we're being asked to do. Nobody can be badgered, bullied, forced, coerced to accept atonement. There has to be in essence, a recognition that it is a better way and a choice to allow those defenses to be reinterpreted. Okay. Deborah.
T2B62. You have perceived it largely as external, thus far, and that is why your experience of it has been minimal. You have been shown the chalice many times, but have not accepted it for yourself. Your major improper use of defenses is now largely limited to externalization. Do not fail to appreciate your own remarkable progress in this respect. You perceived it first as a vessel of some sort whose purpose was uncertain, but which might be a pisspot. You did notice, however, that the inside was gold, while the outside, though shiny, was silver. This was a recognition of the fact that the inner part is more precious than the outer side, even though both are resplendent, though with different value. Doug.
Okay, part of this is Jesus addressing Helen personally about her own personal development as a Course student. And yet we have this word chalice again, which has occurred numerous times in the shorthand notes, a few times in the Ur text, and I think only twice by the time the editing was finished. And I have been puzzling over what the word chalice meant to Helen. It seemed to be probably some reference to the Holy Grail. And in what we're going to be reading today, I think the interpretive key actually emerges. As I was reading over this morning, it suddenly hit me, that's what the chalice is. And a great deal of material before this and the other references later suddenly snapped into focus for me in a way that had never happened before. So I'm just going to draw attention to this chalice now. You've been shown the chalice many times, but you have not accepted it for yourself. What does that mean? What has she been shown? What is she understanding by this word? And then we're told she perceived it first as a vessel of some sort, of uncertain purpose, but it might be a pisspot. But she did notice that inside was gold, while the outside, though shiny, was only silver. So, here's a key element to what the chalice means. This was a recognition of the fact that the inner part is more precious than the outer side of this chalice. Even though both are resplendent, they have a different value. Okay. I'm going to say more about chalice as we get to it going on here. And Carmen, we've talked about this topic before also, and if you have any thoughts to add to it, I'd be very delighted to hear them from you. So T2B63, Deborah.
The reinterpretation of defenses is essential to break open the inner light. Since the separation, man's defenses have been used almost entirely to defend themselves against the atonement and thus maintain their separation. They generally see this as a need to protect the body from external intrusion, in parentheses, or intruding. And this kind of misperception is largely responsible for the homosexual fallacy, as well as your own pregnancy fears. The so-called anal behavior is a distorted attempt to steal the atonement and deny its worth by concealing it and holding on to it in a bodily receptacle, which is regarded as particularly vicious. Oral fantasies are rather similar in purpose, except that they stem more from a sense of deprivation and insatiable thirst, which results. Anal fallacies are more of a refusal to give, while oral fantasies emphasize a distorted need to take. The main error in both is the belief that the body can be used as a means for attaining atonement. Doug.
Okay, first line. Notice the emphasis on the word inner. The reinterpretation of defenses is essential to break open the inner light in relation to the chalice and its inner surface versus its outer surface. The inner-outer theme is critical here to understanding chalice, I think. And then there's some personal comments relating, I think, primarily to Bill about homosexuality. And then some further comments on Freud's anal and oral fantasies. But the summary line, the main error in both or all of these is the belief that the body can be used as a means for attaining atonement. Now, the body would refer to the outer, whereas the first line points out the reinterpretation of defenses is all about breaking open the inner light. Okay, T2B64, Deborah, here you go.
Perceiving the body as the temple is only the first step in correcting this kind of distortion. Parentheses, Helen Schuckman scalded hand and looked for butter to put on. It occurred to her that the atonement was a cure. Burn appeared to minimal and caused little discomfort. Close parenthesis, Doug.
Well, there we have Helen's essentially diary entry. She scalded her hand as this was going on. She's thinking about the atonement would be the cure. And the paragraph is essentially interrupted. This is something that most people would edit out. Perceiving the body as the temple is the first step in correcting this kind of distortion. And the distortion is the idea that the belief that the body can be used as a means for attaining atonement. And then on to T2B65. Deborah? You didn't pick up the mic, Deborah. Are you still with us?
Yeah. I just started reading and I didn't even think to pick up the mic that time. Can you hear me okay? Am I on? Yep. Okay, good. Thanks. I'll post the link here. Carmen. I'm going to post the link here. Hi, Deborah. I just saw you come in. So the new link up here is coming. And this is where we're started. Starting. Okay, at T2B65. Seeing the body as the temple alters part of the misperception, but not all of it. It does recognize, however, that the concept of addition or subtraction in physical terms is not appropriate, because the next step is to realize that a temple is not a building at all. Its real holiness lies in the inner altar, around which the building is built. The inappropriate emphasis which men have put on their beautiful church buildings is a sign of their own fear of atonement and unwillingness to reach the altar itself. The real beauty of the temple cannot be seen with the physical eye. The spiritual eye, on the other hand, cannot see the building at all, but it perceives the altar within with perfect clarity. This is because the spiritual eye has perfect vision. Doug.
Okay. Well, the parallels I'm seeing here across these four or five paragraphs are the contrast being made repeatedly between inner and outer. First, the chalice as an inner and outer. Then, the reinterpretation of defenses is essential to break open the inner light, contrasted with the error in the belief that the body can be used as a means for the atonement, or outer. Then we go into the metaphor of the body as a temple of the Holy Spirit. Perceiving the body as temple is the first step, but only the first step, in correcting that distortion. Seeing the body as the temple alters part of the misperception, but not all of it. What it does alter, and what it recognizes, is that the conception, the concept of addition or subtraction in physical terms is not appropriate. But the next step is to realize that a temple is not a building at all. Its real holiness lies in its inner altar. And then the inappropriate emphasis men have put on beautiful church buildings is a sign of fear of atonement. It's a focus on the outer. And then the real beauty of the temple, body, chalice, cannot be seen with the physical eye. The spiritual eye, on the other hand, cannot see the building, the outer, the body, the temple, the chalice, at all, but it perceives the altar within with perfect clarity. This is because the spiritual eye has perfect vision. Now, the spiritual eye here refers to the human capacity to see without physical eyes, to see the spiritual reality beyond the physical appearances or within the physical appearances. So, back to the chalice in T2B66. Deborah.
For perfect effectiveness, the chalice of the atonement belongs at the center of the inner altar, where it undoes the separation and restores the wholeness of the spirit. Before the separation, the mind was invulnerable to fear, because fear did not exist. Both the separation and the fear were miscreations of the mind, which have to be undone. This is what the Bible means by the restoration of the temple. It does not mean the restoration of the building, but it does mean the opening of the altar to receive the atonement. Doug.
Okay. Now here we have a really interesting expression, the chalice of the atonement. Instead of just chalice, we have chalice of the atonement, undoing, which belongs at the center of the inner altar, the spiritual or soul level altar as opposed to anything physical, where it undoes the separation and restores the wholeness of the spirit. Before the separation, the mind was invulnerable because fear did not exist. Both the separation and the fear were miscreations of the mind which have to be undone. And these miscreations of the mind are blocks to the awareness of love's presence. And finally, this is what the Bible means by it's the prophecy of the restoration of the temple. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with that, but I believe it's in the book of Revelation that in the end times, Solomon's temple in Jerusalem will be rebuilt for a third time. Solomon first built it, then it was destroyed, and then Herod the Great rebuilt it, and then it was destroyed. And the site of the temple is now the Dome of the Rock Mosque, where Muhammad supposedly left earth and was teleported to heaven. But it doesn't mean the restoration of the building, but it means the opening of the altar to receive the atonement or undoing. So the chalice of the atonement is a vessel paralleled with both body and temple that belongs at the center of the inner altar, which only the spiritual eye can see. Now, this is giving some meaning to chalice here that wasn't there in my mind before, when I was seeing these references separately as rather than all of a piece. So, T2B67.
I'll just remind everyone, if there's any questions, clarifications, or experiences the practical experience that you want to share that will help to represent any points that are being made, please raise your hand. So we're at T2B67. This heals the separation and places within man the one defense against all separation mind errors, which can make him perfectly invulnerable. The acceptance of the atonement by everyone is a matter of time. In fact, both time and matter were created for this purpose. This appears to contradict free will because of the inevitability of this decision. If you review the idea carefully, however, you will realize that this is not true. Everything is limited in some way by the manner of its creation. Free will can temporize and is capable of enormous Free will can temporize and is capable of enormous procrastination, but it cannot depart entirely from its creator, who set the limits on its ability to miscreate by virtue of its own real purpose. Doug.
Okay. The acceptance of the atonement by everyone is only a matter of time. Okay. Time and matter were created for this purpose. Then Jesus talks about the apparent contradiction to free will. If it's inevitable, then how can I have free will? My choice is already done. And this really strongly resonates with Workbook Lesson 158, where we read, the script is written. And I think this can be viewed, that the two, Workbook Lesson 158 and this paragraph, can be viewed as two statements of the same idea, which can inform each other if we seek to understand what either really means. Everything is limited in some way by the manner of its creation. Free will can temporize or delay and is capable of enormous procrastination, but it cannot depart entirely from its creator. And the idea of time in Lesson 158, it actually occurred to me to stop at this point and actually read Lesson 158. But well, I'm going to read the paragraph which includes that phrase, the script is written, from Lesson 158. Time is a trick, a sleight of hand, a vast illusion in which figures come and go as if by magic. Yet there is a plan behind appearances which does not change. A plan. The script is written. The plan is the script. When experience will come to end your doubting has been set, or the time when experience will come to end your doubting has been set. For we but see the journey from the point at which it ended, looking back on it, imagining we make it once again, reviewing mentally what has gone by. And I'm sorry Miss B is absent today, because we were talking about this last night. I was talking with her about this in terms of the time travel aspects of atonement and the Course in general. The idea that forgiveness, or the miracle, undoes the past in the present and thus releases the future, which is essentially like going back in time and fixing a mistake we made yesterday. And by forgiving ourselves or others mistakes in the past, effectively we do that because in the process of forgiveness, the consequences of that mistake vanish. It becomes as if it never happened. And that is the aspect of time, which is a vast illusion or a trick or a sleight of hand. It seems to the physical eye that time is linear, sequential, and essentially fixed, and that we absolutely cannot go back. And yet through the Spirit and through our own willingness to cooperate with the Spirit in forgiveness, we can in fact heal memories, go back to the past and undo it. And that is what atonement is. It's an undoing of things that we think of in the past that are irreparable, unfixable, fixed, locked. They're in the history books. Yet we can undo that by changing the way we think about it and thus release the future from any repercussions from the past, because it really it's only our own judgments that take repercussions from the past into the future. If we get them out of our minds in any way at all, then they're no longer there. As Jesus says elsewhere, the only thing true about the past is it's not here. It's gone. And the only way it can be here or have an effect on us is if we, through our minds, invest it with power. So, this was T2B68, the acceptance of the atonement by everyone is only a matter of time. This is also essentially the doctrine of universal salvation, that everybody gets saved in the end. In the early history of the church, there were some church members, Christians, who believed that Jesus, the message of salvation that Jesus had taught was for everyone, and eventually everyone gets to heaven. And there were some who viewed it through a different lens and said, no, only some make it and some don't, which required the invention of the concept of hell as a place where the sinners, the unforgiven, are damned and spend eternity gnashing their teeth. A notion which really didn't get a lot of traction until the Middle Ages, when ideas about hell as a place of fire and torture really became dominant in Christian theology. Before that, it actually plays a pretty small role. Anyways, Jesus is clearly saying here that this idea, largely medieval, about some people never being saved or never making it or never accepting the atonement and never undoing their sins, which have been defined as lacks of love, this idea, he's saying, no, not true. In the end, everybody will accept the atonement or the undoing of their mistakes. And the whole purpose of time and matter and why they were created by God was so that this could take place. That's why we have time and an apparently physical world. They're teaching devices for us to learn how to accept the atonement, or I suppose in the first case, to learn of the necessity of doing so. And then time and matter are there as tools, teaching devices, learning aids for us to accomplish that purpose with Jesus' help. And that is the end of T2B68, which takes us to T2B69. All right, Deborah.
The misuse of will engenders a situation which, in the extreme, becomes altogether intolerable. Pain thresholds can be high, but they are not limitless. Eventually, everybody begins to recognize, however dimly, that there must be a better way. As this recognition is more firmly established, it becomes a perceptual turning point. This ultimately reawakens the spiritual eye, simultaneously weakening the investment in physical sight. The alternating investment in the two types of levels of perception is usually experienced as conflict for a long time and can become very acute. Doug.
Okay, note here that we have something of a definition of levels, as levels of perception in two types. One being the perception accomplished by the spiritual eye, or the world as perceived by the Holy Spirit, and the other being the perception by the physical eye, which will later be essentially equated to the ego. So there's the ego's way of seeing things, and there's the Holy Spirit's way of seeing things. We humans have the capacity to work at either level, the lower level of the ego or the physical, and the higher level of the spiritual perception. We have the organs of perception to see. We have both spiritual eyes and physical eyes. But the spiritual eye is asleep. And the stress that comes from living at the physical level leads everybody eventually to recognize, however dimly, there must be a better way, which was Bill's realization, shared by Helen, that led to the beginning of the course. And as this recognition is more firmly established, that the physical in itself just isn't enough, it becomes the perceptual turning point that ultimately reawakens the spiritual eye, and then weakens the investment in physical sight. But as we alternate between the two, which we tend to do as the spiritual eye is first being reawakened, this alternating investment in the two types or levels of perception is usually experienced as conflict for a long time and can become very acute. So we're being told that this process of waking up through the realization that the physical is in itself inadequate and there's got to be something better, this process of reawakening the spiritual eye is usually experienced as conflict for a long time. So I'll leave that without further comment, except to note the following line in T2B70, which Deborah will read now.
I have a question first. What was my question? I know my question is, how was I going to say it? Would this fit in there, the sense of suddenly seeing everything as a dream, being awake yet seeing everything as a dream state, or that tiered sense of waking up at night from dreams, only finding to be in another dream, and waking up from that one, only finding to be in another dream, finding to be another dream at nighttime, and then finally waking up to this worldly awake sense. So do those fit into what is being talked about here as the development of the spiritual eye, do you think? I'm going to pass the mic to anybody that has a comment on this.
It's too bad Lee Flynn isn't here, because I know he has given a lot of thought to that very question in terms of lucid dreaming and the rather surprising phenomenon that sometimes happens in lucid dreaming, that we become aware we're dreaming and then we think we've wakened up, only to later realize that we were dreaming that we had wakened up in our own bed. That once happened to me, and it was just so bizarre that I awoke from a dream and I realized that I was in exactly the place and spot and bed I had been dreaming I was in after having had a lucid dream from which I had awakened. And it was like totally, totally bizarre. I don't know. I don't, off the top of my head, Deborah, see any connection between the two, except that the metaphor of waking from a dream, I mean, Jesus regularly uses the idea that our normal waking experience at the ego physical level is a dream, in the sense that we made it up. The way our dreams at night, we know that whatever happens there, we made up. It's not real external stuff we're dealing with. I may be driving a car in my dream, but when I wake up, I realize that it wasn't a car that was external to me. It was the product of my own mind inventing a car for me to drive, which symbolizes one thing or another, usually my life. And if I drive the car into a tree, then that's not good news. But anyways, so there is that sense in that waking from a dream at night to ordinary physical consciousness is equated to the process of waking from ordinary physical consciousness to spiritual consciousness. That's often used as a metaphor. And the reality difference between our dreams of the night and our waking consciousness, where we drive real cars that we really don't want to drive into trees, is compared to the difference between the reality we see with the physical eye versus the reality we can see with the spiritual eye, which is a higher order of reality, a different level of perception. Okay, so the alternating investment in these two types or levels of perception is usually experienced as a conflict for a long time, can become very acute, but the outcome is as certain as God. That first line of T2B70 needs to be added to the last line of T2B69 to complete it. Okay. Deborah, your mic. I don't know if I answered you or not.
Yeah, you did. And also I want to check with what Teddy has written here, because it's touching in on what my experience was. Well, you do have experiences of waking here where you know this is a dream at an experiential level, and everyone who has this experience has the same thing. I woke up. And I don't know if it was suddenly in the middle of the day. This is happening more often now. The last time it was very recent. It was very crystal clear that, oh my God, this is a dream. This is a dream. Everything's a dream here, this reality. And I was clearly with a presence of myself. And then there was a very difference between me and the dream of what I was seeing as a dream. And I equate it to the waking up of nighttime dreams, thinking that I'm still, or thinking that I have woken up, but I haven't. So I got that sense of what that feels like. There was a difference in this that, wow, I'm seeing that. It's a dream. It went on for a few minutes, and then it left me. That sense left me. But it wasn't a case of, oh, now I'm awake. I was dreaming. It wasn't anything like that. It was, I don't know if that's clear, but it happens on levels and in stages. Okay, so do you, Teddy, link that to the in with the spiritual eye awakening? I'm sensing that it's somehow linked in there, but I just don't exactly know how. No? Okay. So I'm going to, there's two no's or more no's, so I'm going to be with that more then. I'll carry on. Anybody else have anything? Well, I'm not saying that the spiritual eye only needs that to awaken, but that experience could be possibly that with some people. Yet that experience does awaken the spiritual eye. Okay, that's what I'm kind of thinking, that there's a working in there. Maybe it's so I'm feeling more like I'm on the right track if it's. But I couldn't let it be anyhow. But couldn't it be anyhow? Okay, that was Joanne. Okay. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to carry on here at T2B70. But the outcome is as certain as God. The spiritual eye literally cannot see error and merely looks for atonement. all the solutions which the physical eyes seek dissolve in its sight. The spiritual eye, which looks within, recognizes immediately that the altar has been defiled and needs to be repaired and protected. Perfectly aware of the right defense, it passes over all others, looking past error to truth. Because of the real strength of its vision, it pulls the will into its own service and forces the mind to conquer. This reestablishes the true power of the will and makes it increasingly unable to tolerate delay. The mind then realizes with increasing certainty that delay is only a way of increasing unnecessary pain, which it need not tolerate at all. The pain threshold drops accordingly, and the mind becomes increasingly sensitive to what it would once have regarded as very minor intrusions of discomfort. Doug.
Well, there's a foundation here of a key idea that the Course is going to expand upon and repeat many times in following pages. And that is that the spiritual eye literally cannot see error and merely looks for atonement. Yet the spiritual eye or the Holy Spirit, their sort of primary mission is to recognize the difference between truth and falsehood, what is true and what is false, which is not a concentration on the false and an analysis of the false and a detailing of the false. It is a looking past it, having recognized that it's not true. The spiritual eye, which looks within, recognizes immediately that the altar has been defiled, so that there's something false and needs to be repaired and protected. Perfectly aware of the right defense, which is atonement or undoing, it passes over all others, looking past error to truth. Whereas the ego's tendency would be to focus on the error. Let us study the error. And often never gets to the truth. And then because of the real strength of its vision, it can pull the will into its own service and forces the mind to concur, because the mind will always do what the will tells it to do. And that's the mind to concur, not conquer. This reestablishes the power of the will and makes it increasingly unable to tolerate delay. I'm going over this again. Deborah already read this, but this is so important. It really needs, I think it deserves some focus. The mind then realizes with increasing certainty that delay is only a way of increasing unnecessary pain, which it doesn't need to tolerate. The pain threshold drops accordingly, and the mind becomes increasingly sensitive to and impatient with what it once would have regarded as minor intrusions of discomfort. So as this purification process commences, as the spiritual eye is awakened and communicates with the will, and the will goes along with what the spiritual eye is seeing, our ability to tolerate pain diminishes, and we become more and more sensitive even to the slightest examples of defilement of the altar, or errors, whatever those defilements consist of. Basically, the belief that the physical is the be-all and end-all and the spiritual is at best irrelevant, at worst a myth that doesn't really exist. So the atonement undoes that mistake, and as that undoing proceeds, one way we can recognize it is that we become more sensitive to all such errors of perception in terms of believing that the physical has a reality that it doesn't. Minor discomforts, minor intrusions of discomfort. Okay, Deborah.
Deborah has posted a question, is the spiritual eye the third eye? And I'd like to hear your answer on that as well.
There is a remarkable similarity in what little I know about third eye teachings and what I understand about what the spiritual eye is. It is, I mean, both are spiritual organs of perception that are described as eyes, or using the physical eye as a metaphor, they're organs, perceptual organs, which are capable of perceiving the non-physical element of our reality, of ourselves, of others, of the universe, of God. So yeah, I think it's pretty much, I think they're pretty parallel, but I wouldn't call myself an expert on esoteric literature dealing with third eye. Deborah. Teddy seems to think that they're the same, so that's good.
Well, I'm going over experiences when you were talking. It was bringing up some rememberings. Spiritual eye, or what I referred to as the third eye, that's the only thing that I could context a lot of experiences into, because all I ever heard about was the third eye after I was having experiences, so that's what I filtered it into and called it. And that seemed to be so different than what I'm experiencing right now with this recognizing that, wow, I'm dreaming as I'm wide awake. It seems to be channeling in differently. The psychic eye or third eye was picking up on lots of what was connected. I don't know. There seemed to be something different. Maybe there's a further development from that to the spiritual eye, is kind of like more of a sense that I'm getting, that there is, that it's a way, it's one of the stepping stones to that more spiritual eye, where you see beyond all the physical form, and you're left with just this clear sight. Because with the psychic eye, I also pick up distortions in people and in their energy fields and things. So that's what's I'm tripping on right now, that those two differences.
Okay, well, one distinction I think might be significant in terms of understanding what these words are meaning to communicate is that the spiritual eye refers to the capacity to see spiritually, the way physical eye refers to the capacity to see physical objects where there's light. It doesn't let's just think about physical eye for a minute. My eye doesn't refer to what I see. If I look out the window, I see one thing with my eye. If I look at my feet in the room, I see another thing with my eye. If I look at the screen of my computer, I see yet another thing with my eye. The eye is the perceptual organ with which I perceive all these different things, but it's not the things I'm perceiving. So the spiritual eye doesn't refer to that which is perceived, but rather the level of perception where the perception is happening. So the physical eye perceives things that are physical, all things that are physical, where there's light at a spectrum that the eye can register. The spiritual eye operates at a different level of perception and can see other things. So through that spiritual eye, I think the whole concept of revelation, which we were talking about last month, is revelations from God come through the spiritual eye. But the spiritual eye is not the revelation. The pain another might be experiencing but hiding behind bravado and anger is something the spiritual eye can see. The physical eye certainly can't see that. So the I think what it's referring to here is not that which is perceived, but the capacity to perceive at certain levels, or at different levels here. And the idea being conveyed is that the spiritual eye is asleep for one caught up in the separation illusion. The physical eye is wide awake and thinking that the physical is the only thing that's real. And as the spiritual eye awakens, the mind gains access to more and more spiritual knowledge because the data is coming in through this awakening sense organ, and reality starts to seem different, which can lead to disequilibrium. And as we alternate or vacillate between the two ways of seeing, there can be a great deal of conflict because the reality our spiritual eye is telling us is sometimes so different from the reality revealed by our spiritual eye. And until we've made a decision for one or the other, we're in conflict between two very different ways of seeing, being, understanding, knowing. So I think that's, I think that pertains to what you were asking, Deborah. I'm not entirely sure. But I'm going to hand you back the mic.
There's a lot that's written on the board about this. So did you want to read it, Doug, or shall I go down the board and read what's being said here? So I think it's probably important, too. If you want, go ahead and read it. Okay. Boy, that's really tiny writing. I need triple glasses. Okay, I'm going to start up here. Okay, Carmen has, yes, the spiritual eye sees beyond appearances. Reflected words, it is the mind's eye. And then Teddy's, yes, it's the same idea. Dove adds, third eye is not fooled by form. And Teddy's saying the third eye, spiritual eye, is associated with the forehead, and you can feel the activity in the center of your forehead. It is associated with the pineal gland. That's for the spiritual eye, third eye, spiritual eye. You're referring to it as the same thing. Dove has, it's our right mind, being in my right mind, and Teddy, and the activity of it. Is that, I think that's activity. The pineal gland starts to dry up at about age 7. Adele with the huh? Or huh? Probably a huh. Teddy adds, when you have begun to integrate bodily awarenesses. Carmen posts, the pineal gland actually has rod and cones like the physical eye, but it sees something internal being projected interdimensionally onto the fluid held within the gland. Teddy says, the more and more you believe what the physical eyes see, the more you believe what you see is real, the less your spiritual eye is experienced as active. There is a tradition where each gland is associated with a spiritual center or chakra, and when they are completely activated and active as one, a single drop of fluid is released that can only be released when that is accomplished. And that single drop is what brings immortality. And Christian adds in, God is everything I see. And forget the rest. Good Christian. Carmen adds in, age 7 is called the age of reason, meaning we've accepted and adapted to our culture's world view. And my add-in on this is, I'm still not buying either way. I'm still not linked into a conclusion on either way, because the two sites that I'm experiencing currently seem very different. Whether that's going to shift and integrate more into a sameness, I don't know, because I have been seeing light very clearly since I was, auras and things since I was a teenager, and feeling all of it since I was a child. So there seems to be something different that is happening now that is transforming within me, and what I am what I am seeing. There's a, it's happening in a very different way, so I can't give any kind of a clear sense on it. Nothing's ringing a bell that says, yes, that's it. So, Doug, here's the mic again.
Well, I was thinking about telepathic experiences where we come to know what someone is thinking or know what someone is doing or know what is happening to someone without any physical data at all, without using any physical organs of perception. And I think that that is somehow analogous to the spiritual eye. It's not restricted to seeing. It could be hearing. It could be knowing. It could be feeling. And again, the capacity to communicate with someone at that level does not relate to what gets communicated any more than, as I use the metaphor of the physical eye, the fact that I have a voice and can speak to you doesn't say anything about what I'm speaking to you. The fact that I have ears and can hear you has no bearing on what you say to me. I will hear it, whatever it is, presumably. So I think that what we're talking about here is awakening the capacity to perceive at the spiritual level of perception, which operates with sense organs other than our physical eyes, ears, nose, etc., etc., and allows us to have access to knowledge or information that is not available to our physical senses. And the kind of knowledge we get probably is probably influenced by the kind of knowledge we seek, the kind of knowledge that is of interest to us, the kind of knowledge that would appeal to us, in which we would have some interest, that seems to follow. So, on that point, I'm going to drop the mic and mention that we left off the reading at TB71. And for anybody who's just tuned in recently.
Okay, yeah, I thought maybe you dropped the mic prematurely there. I would just read a little bit more. Workbook, Carmen's saying, workbook talks about the light episodes being a turning point in our scene, lesson 11 or 12. I don't remember which one either, Carmen, for anybody that wants to look it up. And Teddy's saying, seeing light around the edges of things. Christian, for me it's very important because I want to be very clear about what my sight has been, is, and what is happening now to fit it all together. I want it to come together and click for me, and it's very helpful when this is discussed in groups such as this. So that's why I go there. The psychic awareness, the same as an active third eye. Is psychic awareness the same as, okay, I think Doug just touched on that, and that's what we've been talking about, right, Deborah? Has that been answered enough for you? Where are we down here? Teddy writes, we are also perceiving at the spiritual level, becoming aware of that perception is eliminating the perceptions that are not that, is what purification is, yeah. Yeah, I'm fitting it. Yeah, and there's that disorientation. I'm in the disorientation of some of that. So yeah, I thanks. I can see that clearly right now. Disorientation. Okay, so I'm going to. Oh, the pineal doesn't dry up in everybody using it. Keeps it active. Oh, thank you, Carmen, for that. So we're starting at T2B71. The children of God are entitled to perfect comfort, which comes from a sense of perfect trust. Until they achieve this, they will waste themselves and their true creative power on useless attempts to make themselves more comfortable by inappropriate means. But the real means is already provided and does not involve any efforts on their part at all. Their egocentricity usually misinterprets this as personally insulting, an interpretation which obviously arises from their misperception of themselves. Egocentricity and communion cannot coexist. Even the terms themselves are contradictory. The atonement is the only gift which is worthy of being offered to the altar of God. This is because of the inestimable value of the altar itself. It was created perfect and is entirely worthy of receiving perfection. God is lonely without his souls, and they are lonely without him. Remember the spiritual, in parenthesis, a very good term, which begins with, "And God stepped down from heaven and said, I'm lonely. I'll make me a world." The word was a way of healing the separation, and the atonement is the guarantee that the device will ultimately do so. Doug.
Okay. We were talking before about the pain threshold drops and our patients with mild intrusions of discomfort diminishes. T2B71 begins with the children of God, which would be us, are entitled to perfect comfort, which comes from a perfect sense of trust. The question being, trust in what? Until they achieve this, they will waste themselves and their true creative power on useless attempts to make themselves more comfortable by inappropriate means. But the real means, in which the real trust is appropriate, is already provided and does not involve any efforts on their parts at all. Now, the word ego shows up for the first time in the course right here. Their egocentricity usually misinterprets this as personally insulting because we can't do anything to earn it. It's basically a gift of grace. So the egocentricity misinterprets it as insulting, an interpretation which obviously arises from a misperception of themselves. Okay, egocentricity and communion cannot exist. The terms themselves are contradictory. So the communion with others and with God in love, which is all-powerful and which can deliver all comfort, is the object of the trust. Okay. An atonement or undoing is the only gift which is worthy of being offered to the altar of God. In other words, we're being told we don't have anything to offer to God except the undoing of the ideas we had that were not his. God is lonely without his souls, and they are lonely without him. And the undoing is the means of reparation or restoration of that communion with God. And in that, the atonement, we must have perfect trust. The trust, as a verb, has as its object atonement. That is the only way out. Nothing else we can do can possibly get us there. That's what we're being told here, and that's a pretty stunning, startling message. And it is, of course, absolutely insulting to the ego, who thinks, well, I can do something. Yeah, right. Okay. And now we have a little note from Helen, which Deborah can read now. And that brings us to the end of that segment and the beginning of a new one. Deborah.
T2B73, parentheses. Helen Schuckman request for special message for Bill. Tell Bill that his delaying tactics are holding him back. He does not really understand detachment, distanciation, and withdrawal. He is interpreting them as holding himself aloof from the atonement. Doug, here you go.
Okay, I have really no idea what that means in specific. Helen's asking for a message. I'm not aware of any recording of such a message. Tell Bill his delaying tactics are holding him back. I suppose that's the message. and he doesn't really understand detachment, distanciation, and withdrawal, and I don't know what he's understanding or not understanding or why there. So I can't offer any enlightenment on that one line. It's one of many where Helen writes something down that I'm sure she understands perfectly, and it refers to or alludes to something else, sometimes even something that's said to be written, but we don't have, or I don't have at least, access to that material. So I don't know what, you know, she's referring to, what the reference is to. Anyways, Deborah.
T2, C2. As we noted yesterday, the atonement is the remedy. The order of error to which atonement is applied is irrelevant. Essentially, all healing is the release from fear. But to undertake this, you cannot be fearful yourself. You do not understand healing. Doug, I'll pass it on to you. Unless you want me to read another paragraph first. T2C1. Oh, did I miss a whole paragraph there? I did. Okay, I'll go back up there. Healing as release from fear. Wow. Yeah, I see that now. T2C1. The new emphasis will now be on healing. The miracle is the means, the atonement the principle, and the healing is the result. Those who speak of the miracle of healing are combining two orders of reality inappropriately. Healing is not a miracle. The atonement, or the final miracle, is extremely useful. It is purely a means which any type of healing is a result. As we noted yesterday, the atonement is the remedy. The order of error to which atonement is applied is irrelevant. Essentially, all healing is the release from fear, but to undertake this, you cannot be fearful yourself. Doug.
Okay, I'm just going to point out that we're switching here from blocks to the awareness of love's presence and ego defenses to healing. The miracle is the means, the atonement or the undoing is the principle, and healing is the result. And then this interesting line, healing is not a miracle. The atonement or the final miracle is extremely useful. So the atonement is the principle, the miracle is the means, and these are the things in which we must have perfect trust. And if we trust anything else, then the miracle or the atonement, which is undoing the blocks we've created, we will get nowhere precisely fast. And the result is the healing. So, as we noted yesterday, the atonement is the remedy in which we must trust. And the order of error to which the atonement is applied is irrelevant. The spiritual eye or the Holy Spirit doesn't focus on errors. It just recognizes it's either an error or it's not. It's either true or it's false. And if it's false, you go to the truth. You don't focus on the falsehood. You don't focus on the error. You just go to the truth when the error has been recognized as error. So the order of error or the size or the magnitude of the error is irrelevant, as are the details. And essentially, all healing is the release from fear. But to undertake this, you cannot be fearful yourself, which is a very, very interesting comment. And that takes us to T2C3, I believe. I don't think you read that one yet. Yeah. Okay, Deborah, here you go.
Correct. Do you understand? Nope. You do not understand healing because of your own fear. I have been hinting throughout, parentheses, and once stated very directly, because you were unfearful at the time, close parenthesis, that you must heal others. The reason is that they're healing merely witnesses or attests to yours. A major step in the atonement plan is to undo error at all levels. Illness, which is really not right-mindedness, is a result of level confusion in the sense that it always entails the misbelief that what is amiss in one level can adversely affect another. Doug.
Okay, Keith, concept number one. You must heal others. And Helen is afraid of this, but once she was unfearful and it got through clear, that in itself is significant. Why must you heal others? The reason is that they're healing merely witnesses or attests to yours. In other words, this is related to it, is the privilege of the forgiven to forgive. If you are forgiven, you will be forgiving. If you are healed, you will be healing. This also relates to later material. If you wish to have, you first must be anything at all. When you are, then you have. So the being and having are closely related, and when you have healing, you will be healing. So you must heal others. You can't not if you are healed. When you are healed. And the converse is true. If you're not, you can't. Which is a very significant kind of concept. Then a major step in the atonement is to undo errors at all levels, which would mean both physical and spiritual. Illness, which is really a not right-mindedness, is the result of level confusion in the sense that it always entails the misbelief that what is amiss on one level can adversely affect another. And many times later on, Jesus will tell us that problems must be solved at the level at which they occur. And I'm not going to go into that one any further right now. Question on board, reflected words, is that it? Fear and love cannot coexist in the same thought, and atonement can be reached from only love and not fear. Fear and love cannot coexist in the same thought. I would say that's true. And atonement or undoing can only be reached or achieved from only love and not fear. Yes. I mean, what we want to undo is all those thoughts whose result is fear. Because anything that leads us to think fearfully would be an illusion, a mistake, a misperception, an error, a lack of love. So what the target of the atonement is anything whose result is fear, amongst other things, but certainly that. So fear and love cannot coexist. There is no room for fear and love. Perfect love casts out fear. In the same thought, an atonement can be reached only from love, yes, and not from fear. Yes, where there's fear, the message of fear to me is simply something needs undoing. If I am fearful, I must have misthought. I must have misperceived. I must have made a mistake. And look to the truth, which is always essentially a denial of fear. Whatever thought, this bad storm might kill me, I'm scared of the tornado, that's a misperception. There's nothing to fear. If my body happens to pick this moment to leave this plane, well, that's just the way it is. That's nothing I need fear. Ego would fear, but truth would not be fearful in that moment. Okay. Hopefully that's answered, and we're now at T2C5, I do believe. And Deborah, here is the mic. And while you read this paragraph, I'm going to step out to the washroom. I shouldn't be too long.
It's only a little wee paragraph. It's okay, I can go on. T2C5, we have constantly referred to miracles as the means of correcting level confusion. In reality, all mistakes must be corrected at the level at which they occur. Only the mind is capable of error. The body can act erroneously, but this is only because it has responded to misthought. The body cannot create, and the belief that it can, a fundamental error responsible for most of the fallacies already referred to, produces all physical symptoms. All physical illness represents a belief in magic. The whole distortion which created magic rested on the belief that there is a creative ability in matter, which can control the mind. This fallacy can work either way, i.e., it can be misbelieved either that the mind can miscreate in the body, or that the body can miscreate in the mind. So the two ways, I'll read that again. This fallacy can work either way, i.e., it can be misbelieved either that the mind can miscreate in the body, or that the body can miscreate in the mind. If it can be made clear that the mind, which is the only level of creation, cannot create itself, cannot create beyond itself, then neither confusion need occur. Doug.
Okay, there is a really, really, really crucial concept about levels and solving problems at the level at which they occur here. And the basic principle is that only the mind is capable of error. The body cannot act erroneously. The body can act erroneously, but this is only because it has responded to a misthought. It's like that argument, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Gun as metaphor for body, people as metaphor for mind. Obviously, until someone picks up a gun and uses it, the gun itself is a piece of inert matter, which will just sit there and rust if left unattended. An activating agent for our bodies is our mind. Our body does nothing on its own. It does not get sick on its own, yet it is a profound belief in contemporary Western culture that bodies do get sick by themselves, and that the villain is that bacteria that infected my body. And if I attack the bacteria, I may get well. That's magic, and it works to a certain level, but it misses the central point, is what we're being told here. So all physical illness represents a belief in magic. That is a very, very sweeping, all-encompassing statement, which a lot of people tend to doubt is valid or true. And it rests on, as we're told here, the belief there is a creative ability in matter, which can control the mind, that my body can get sick on its own, and having gotten sick, my mind has to obey the belief that I now have a broken leg, or I now have the flu. I mean, I do it. Most people I know do it. I don't know too many people who don't do it. So that would be the misbelief that the body can miscreate in the mind, that what the body does essentially controls the mind. It can be made clear that the mind, which is the only level of creation, cannot create beyond itself. If it can be made clear, then neither confusion need occur. And so what Jesus is going to try to do here is make that clear to us, having recognized that if we do get clear on it, then that particular kind of level confusion need not occur. This is a biggie. This is a very, very fundamental perceptual transformation from the way we grew up thinking, and we're pretty sure is true, that those illnesses are caused by those bacteria or viruses or whatever, and to recognize that the mind is the only level of creation. And if I didn't believe in bacteria, well, essentially, if I didn't believe in magic, that matter can influence mind, then I wouldn't be confused about that. Which takes us to T2C7, I think. I don't know. Did you read that one? Anyways, I presume, Deborah, you know where you left off.
Yeah, I start back in at C7. I want to give a couple examples in here, one I've used before, but it fits into so many places, you know. This place, for sure. Years ago, when my children were young and I was still believing in medical, I was testing out my beliefs about medical, actually. And I remember I wasn't feeling well at all and felt myself to go to the medical doctor. And when I went in and sat in his office, the minute he walked into the room, I felt a sense of relief and all my symptoms disappeared. And I knew immediately, whoa, my belief is so strong that the doctor can help me and I'm sick with something, I need the help from this doctor. That seeing him, that I just immediately relaxed and all symptoms went. So that was an eye-opener for me on what my mind was doing. And another was an eye-opener for me on the level of what my mind was caught in, that I was a little bit out of touch with. That one I could get immediately and see it. The second example was when I was breastfeeding one of my children. It was actually my last child who I had birthed at home. And I also was running a business. So on I think it was the second day, the day after he was born, I went into the store. Was this the day after or the day after that? I can't remember. I went in to check my business out. But everything was fine. I was very, very relaxed. The whole process was very relaxing for me. And as I drove out the laneway, I lived in the country, and as I drove out the laneway headed toward town on the road, I felt my milk release. And my milk releasing was a sense of, when my child wasn't near me, was a sense of stress. I had no sense of that stress in my body, and I have usual ways of telling whether I'm in stress, whether there's some kind of an anxiety is going on, but there was none there, and I realized instantly on that one that the mind can be pushing it down so deeply that our blocks, we can really block out so much. So these awarenesses are very helpful to just start immediately removing the blocks and letting all of that come through. I'm not going to piece the end of that together, but I just wanted to pass on those experiences. So I'm going to go ahead and start reading with T2C7. The reason why only the mind can create is more obvious than may be immediately apparent. The soul has been created. The body is a learning device for the mind. Learning devices are not lessons in themselves. Their purpose is merely to facilitate the thinking of the learner. The most that a faulty use of a learning device can do is to fail to facilitate. It does not have the power in itself to introduce actual learning errors. Doug.
Okay, I noticed Carmen saying the definition of magic here is crucial and often lost or overlooked, and I agree totally. It is never in any of the course material I've seen given a specific definition all by itself. The term is used in a context which presumes that the audience already knows exactly what is meant by magic. And I'm guessing that Helen knew, and there's probably some conversation between her and Jesus in which this was explained, which has not survived history to be in our hands. So we can only learn of its definition by looking at how it's used throughout the course. And this is a very, this paragraph, T2C6, comes as close as anything does to giving us a definition, that all physical illness represents a belief in magic. The distortion which created magic rested on the belief that there is a creative ability in matter which can control the mind. And that, as I understand it, is the belief that I am a victim of matter, that my thoughts, what I think, can be controlled by stuff, be that stuff other bodies, weather systems, trees falling on my head. We believe that. And how we believe it is fairly obvious. As infants, we learn that if we fall down, it hurts. We learn that if we touch something hot, it hurts. So we're learning that the matter, the floor, the stove, whatever, controls our thoughts, because we think, I'm hurt. Ouch. Wah, 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 mommy, mommy. Whatever. And that's a belief generated, that comes from the experience of thinking you're a body, which is the kind of thought form that normally develops in a creature who is born in a body. You experience what the physical organs deliver to your mind, and you interpret those, and your parents interpret those for you as, don't touch the stove, it can hurt you. Be careful, don't step on a nail. The nail can hurt you or control your mind. And all this, we believe it. We believe that's how the world works, is the belief in magic. Or magic-mindedness, you might say, which is contrasted repeatedly in the Course with miracle-mindedness, that the real cause is very different than the real cause-effect relationships are actually the reverse of what our physical body tells us are the cause-effect relationships. Because our body tells us that matter does control us, and that I am matter, I am a body. That's the basic foundational, you know, the basic foundation of the ego thought system. I am a body, and therefore I can be hurt by other bodies and other physical stuff. And my mind is not in control of this, but is essentially a victim of the physical processes that impact my body. And my thoughts are responses to physical stimuli. The most radical thing the Course has to say is that the opposite is true. That it's our thoughts that attract physical experiences which reflect those thoughts. So it's really the thought that I am a body and that matter has power over me that attracts the experience to confirm it. So this teaching device, this neutral teaching device, is essentially something that can be considered as an analogy to a movie screen upon which we project our thoughts, and the screen reflects back to us what we're projecting. And whatever we see out, quote, out there, unquote, is at some level what we have, what we believe, what we think, and the kinds of thoughts which we have projected or extended into the universe. And it's, you know, that famous line, projection makes perception, in chapter 21, I believe it is, goes on to say, to paraphrase, if you project fear, what you're going to see is fearful. If you project love, what you're going to see is loving. That's how the teaching device works. So we're also taught to be mindful of our thoughts and to exercise vigilance over what we think. And somebody reflected words, be aware of your thoughts. Yes, absolutely. If you're not aware of them, you can't control them. They will control you. And they will largely be semi-conscious ego thoughts and the belief in magic. If you are conscious and you can recognize the difference between a true thought and a false thought, and deny the reality of the false and embrace the reality of the true, then perception begins to change. And you can recognize and stop obeying the false thoughts, the magic thoughts, and you can start recognizing and obeying the miraculous thoughts, the loving thoughts, the miracle-minded thoughts. And in that process, which is linked to the awakening of the spiritual eye, the practice of the Course occurs, and one learns how it is that one's experience in the teaching device is a function of what we think. And whatever it is we're experiencing, somehow or other, traces back to something we thought, which was the causal, creative factor that generated the experience which we're having. So, somebody gets mad at you and blows up and starts insulting you. What's going on? What's going on is that I attracted this thought because I need healing in this area, and what this person is doing, how I'm interpreting what he's doing, my experience of what he's doing, is simply showing me where I need healing. And the appropriate response, according to what the Course has to say, is to turn to Jesus and ask for help, because I can't do it, and to trust implicitly that that help is there, and that that help will be the undoing of whatever thought processes of mine generated the experience which is coming to me. So if I don't like the experience, again, chapter 30, the 7 rules for decision, really drives this home in a very, very, very profound, precise way. If I don't like what's going on, I can at least recognize I must have made a mistake. I can at least recognize I don't like it. So I must have thought wrongly somewhere. And with that thought comes that little willingness to accept there must be a better way, and I don't know what it is, at which point, if the spiritual eye is even slightly open, Jesus can show us what it is, and it will usually be forgiveness, which results in undoing, which undoes the whole manifestation of miserableness or unhappiness that we are experiencing, and in that process our thoughts are corrected, so we start thinking healthy, healing, wholesome, true thoughts instead of unhealthy, unwholesome, untrue thoughts, and experience is transformed. And altogether, I think added up, that could be called a miracle. And it often is accompanied by miracle manifestations of a physically improbable sort, where stuff changes as the mind changes, because the stuff is reflecting the mind. The mind is the controller here. That's supremely crucial to understand that idea, that whatever is happening is something I have drawn into my experience for my benefit, so that I can see, if it's a negative experience, it's so I can see where my thought needs healing, where I have made a mistaken thought. All right, I'm waxing along on this and not reading the board, and I'm going to stop and hand the mic back to Deborah and read the board.
T2C8. The body, if properly understood, shares the invulnerability of the atonement to two-edged application. This is not because the body is a miracle, but because it is not inherently open to misinterpretation. The body is merely a fact. Its abilities can be, and frequently are, over-evaluated. However, it is almost impossible to deny its existence. Those who do are engaging in a particularly unworthy form of denial. Parentheses, the use of the word unworthy here implies simply that it is not necessary to protect the mind by denying the unmindful. There is little doubt that the mind can miscreate. If one denies this unfortunate aspect of its power, one is also denying the power itself. Close parenthesis. Doug.
Okay. Reflected Words writes, if we taught that the fall does not hurt, this would be teaching the child, I presume, that falling down doesn't hurt, would the fall still hurt? And I think the answer has just been given in this paragraph. that the body, if properly understood, shares the invulnerability of the atonement to two-edged application. Not because it's a miracle, but because it's not inherently open to misinterpretation. It is merely a fact. Its abilities can be and frequently are over-evaluated. However, it's almost impossible to deny its existence. Now, I think denying its existence would be like telling a child that he's imagining things if he scrapes his knee when he falls down. He's not imagining things. That is what's going on. That's the fact of the experience of his teaching device in that moment. The issue is, what's it for and what does it mean, little one, that this experience has been drawn into your life? Not, did this experience occur? Or not to deny that you have a body that can be wounded and hurt. But to look at how come, what's this about, what does it mean, and what's the way to address it? Fear not being the right answer, but fear being the way a child tends to react to anything that hurts. And those who do deny the body are engaging in a particularly unworthy form of denial. And the word unworthy here implies that it's not necessary to protect the mind by denying the unmindful. So protecting the mind by denying the body, it's not necessary. It's, in fact, counterproductive. There is little doubt that the mind can miscreate, but if one denies this unfortunate aspect of its power, one is also denying the power of the mind itself. So that's as close as I can come right now to answering that question. And it's a supremely important question on a whole number of counts, which will be addressed further and in more detail as we proceed. So I'm not going to anticipate the next chapter by trying to summarize it now. And I'm going to hand the mic back to you, Deborah.
All material means which man accepts as remedies for bodily ills are simply restatements of magic principles. It was the first level of the error to believe that the body created its own illness. Thereafter, it is a second misstep to attempt to heal it through non-creative agents. It does not follow, however, that the application of these very weak corrective devices is evil. Sometimes the illness has sufficiently great a hold over an individual's mind to render him inaccessible to atonement. In this case, one may be wise to utilize a compromise approach to mind and body, in which something from the outside is temporarily given healing, relief, or belief. This is because the last thing that can help the non-right-minded, in parentheses, or the sick, is an increase in fear. They are already in a fear-weakened state. If they are inappropriately exposed to a straight and undiluted miracle, they may be precipitated into panic. This is particularly likely to occur when upside-down perception has induced the belief that miracles are frightening. Doug.
I think this is the second part of the answer to what you tell a kid if he falls down and scratches his knee and it hurts. The first thing you would do is apply some antiseptic and give the kid reassurance that the world is still a safe and loving place. And that he is loved and will be cared for. And we're being told here that it does not follow that the application of these very weak corrective devices, magic, is evil. Sometimes it's necessary. because sometimes the miraculous intervention would itself generate more fear. And one thing the Holy Spirit and Jesus will never do is anything that will increase fear. And that is because the last thing that can help the non-right-minded or the sick is an increase in fear. They are already in a fear-weakened state, and the appropriate thing to do is something that will reduce their fear. And we are now down to 8 minutes, and this is such an important topic, but we have only one more paragraph in this segment. So let's do that paragraph and then we'll wind up for today, Deborah.
Carmen has her hand up, so I'm going to pass the mic on to Carmen.
Thank you, sweethearts. Can you hear me? Thank you. I'll be really brief with this since I'm on in a few minutes, but I just wanted to put in here. When I was a child, one of my cousins came down with the measles, and this was before they had all kinds of preventions for measles. And what the doctor recommended was to put all of the children in my generation in the family in the same bedroom so that we would all get measles at this very early age. We were all below the age of 7. And I have a very clear memory of sitting in that room looking at my cousins, scratching themselves and all red bumps and everything, and just deciding that I wasn't going to do that. And I never came down with the measles, and they held us in the room trying to wait for me to catch the measles, and I never did. So after about a week, they let us out, and my cousins were mostly over it, and I never came down with it. But to me, if that had been reinforced from my mother or some authority figure at an early age, I believe my invulnerability to disease throughout my life would have been greatly enhanced. But it was an internal experience, and I didn't share it with anybody, and the adults were just confused. But I'm thinking that, you know, what Jesus is telling us here is that that is a possibility for us to teach our children that they can just refuse to agree to being sick, and we'll, you know, we can reinforce that belief in children. And we just don't, and so it doesn't happen. So I just wanted to share that as a personal experience that I've had in me since I got the Course in Miracles, and I've used it to relate a lot of what the Course says to my own personal experience, so that I do believe it is possible for us to tell children, like Helen with her burn, that she can claim the atonement. She can claim the power of her mind, and she doesn't have to be a victim of the matter. Thank you, dears.
Well, thank you, Carmen. And that's beautiful, and it strongly reminds me of an experience I had in my early 20s when I read of an experiment or a medical report of the critical part is that there was that was in the days when smallpox vaccinations were in vogue, because smallpox still existed and the World Health Organization was trying to eradicate it. And by accident, a group of several thousand children were given a bad batch of smallpox vaccine. It actually had a live smallpox agent in it. And all of these kids should have gotten smallpox from the vaccine. Some of them did, but many of them didn't, which sort of set the whole epidemiological community in a tizzy, because smallpox is something to which humans are not supposed to have natural immunity, yet a lot of these kids didn't. A related similar story occurred far more recently in Nigeria, I believe it was, which has a huge problem with HIV/AIDS, particularly amongst those employed in the sex trade. A couple of women were identified by researchers, a couple of women involved in the sex trade were identified who, by all standards, should have had HIV, but didn't. And a great deal of study went into figuring out what physical entity was happening with these people that seemed to give them immunity to the disease. And I was already a course student by that time and thinking, shouldn't the right question be like a psychometric question? Like, what are they thinking that protects them? as opposed to what is it about their DNA or their immune systems that could be found in a biochemical lab, I'd be more inclined to take them to a psychometric lab and find out what is psychologically or spiritually unique about these people that they can literally, you know, bullets bounce off their bodies. They're assaulted by this virulent disease day after day after day, and it has no effect on them. How come? And, you know, there's many examples of that, I'm sure, but it suggests to me that the relevance of the Course, if believed at all, would have a profound effect not just on psychological research, as Jesus is suggesting to Helen, a psychological researcher, it should, but on all manner of studies of cause and effect and how we deal with the problems we experience as humans. So we do have 2 minutes and we have one paragraph. Let's get this paragraph done, Deborah.
T2C10. The value of the atonement does not lie in the manner in which it is expressed. In fact, if it is truly used, it will inevitably be expressed in whatever way is most helpful to the receiver, not the giver. I think that's so important. This means that a miracle to attain its full efficacy, that's a difficult word for me, must be expressed in a language which the recipient can understand without fear. I'll read that again. This means that a miracle, to attain its full efficacy, must be expressed in a language which the recipient can understand without fear. It does not follow by any means that this is the highest level of communion of which he is capable, but it does mean that it is the highest level of communication. All right, that other... Oh, man, I'm trying to rush this, Doug. It does not follow by any means that this is the highest level of communication of which he is capable, but it does mean that it is the highest level of communication of which he is capable now. Here you go.
Well, yeah, that is hugely significant. And it's another way of saying that the miracle worker and the miracle medium, you or I, and the source of the miracle, Jesus and the Holy Spirit, when operating properly and appropriately, will always communicate to the beneficiary of the miracle at the highest level of communication of which he is capable now. And that will vary from individual to individual and day to day in any one individual. And there's no law book, rule book, recipe for how that gets communicated. It could be in any way at all. That Jesus knows each of us, each of our hearts, and what we can understand and what will cause us fear. And through the miracle worker will always address us appropriately, expressed in a language which the recipient can understand without fear. Crucial. So anytime you think of telling somebody something that's going to scare them, no, that's not miracle-mindedness at work. and anytime you're told something that scares you, no, that's not miracle-mindedness in the other at work. It's simply missing the point. Take your time, guys. Okay, Carmen. We'll take our time. 1 minute now. That brings us to the end of this segment, and next week we'll pick up on T2C11. And thank you all for being here, and thank you for your contributions, questions, observations. As usual, it's a very enriching experience for me. I learned so much in the process of sharing this material with you and gaining the benefit of your observations and insights. It's a delight. And on that note, I'm going to drop the mic and let Deborah say her goodbyes. God bless you all.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks very much, radio participants. Thanks very much, Dove, for providing the venue again. Thank you so much for doing that. And this is to be continued next Sunday, June 27th, 4 to 6 in the afternoon. Bye.